Greet each one of you in Jesus' name this morning. Again, it's been a privilege to be here. Thank you, Brother Steve, for those thoughts. I was challenged with that just recently. I was thinking some of those thoughts just recently. Came upon a situation where I wasn't sure whether I should fear for my physical safety or not. And I did what I do in situations like that. I called 911 and left it in other people's hands. And I think that was probably what needed to be done in that situation. But you know, there's not to be political this morning, but there's a lot of government programs out there to help needy people. There's a lot of, you can get some people's needs met, but there's just no substitute for compassion and a heart of love to reach out to people. Thank you for that challenge. Thank you, each one of you students this morning, for making that commitment. I was blessed, and I think thrilled would be the right word. I was moved this morning. As we were singing that song, I Love You, Lord Jesus, I was especially moved with the two phrases, my body is yours for anything, Lord, and I'm satisfied now in your love. And I took a little bit different thought on that, Brother Steve. I was thinking of, they could apply many different ways, I'm sure, but not needing to be somewhere else. I'm satisfied right here, whatever. My body's yours for you to use it like you want to. And if it's not the way I would choose for my body to be used, I'm satisfied in your love anyway. But as we were singing, I hope it's okay for preachers to do this. I was making the commitment myself, but I did wonder. I just wondered. I watched your faces. You might have noticed that. You might not have. Some of you looked like you were really thinking about what you were singing about. Others I couldn't tell. And I just wondered how many of us are making this commitment, or how many people are wondering what impression they're leaving on the person on the bench beside them, or what, all those things that can be in our minds. I hope that together we made those commitments. Because if you really made that commitment, I was moved by the thought of what God can do with a group of young people like this that really committed themselves in that way. There's just a lot of compassion that can be shown, a lot of needs that can be met, right, Brother Steve? There's just, the gospel is going to go forth in a mighty way. Well, I would like to ask you to commit yourselves again before we go any further into the sermon, by singing. We're just going to sing two verses this morning. I think we'll sing verse 1 and 3. You may stand. And can you get us a picture, brother, please? 273, I'm sorry. 273 is the number. Take my heart over. I'm sorry.
Take my heart, O Father, take it. Make and keep it all thine own. Let thy Spirit melt and break it, this proud heart of sin and stone. Ever let
Well, this morning for a sermon, the inspiration for this sermon came from an unlikely place. Maybe I'll give you the title before we go any further so that you can write it down. I want to talk a little bit, just have a little, before we get to the meat of the sermon. But the title of this morning's sermon is Overcoming the Disease Mentality. Now, I gave you that partly so you could write it down and partly to make you wonder what in the world we're going to talk about this morning, okay? Overcoming the Disease Mentality. Now, the inspiration came from a billboard, okay? And I really wondered what it meant. I was driving through Hattiesburg, a town east of here. Most of you probably came through it on the way here. You may or may not remember it. A fairly large town. And on the main, one of the main boulevards through town, Highway 98 actually, but anyway, right through the middle of town, in one of the, I would suppose, probably one of the highest cost for billboards in that section, a lot of these LED billboards, and I'm sure advertising in that section is not cheap at all, was this billboard that said, alcohol addiction is a disease, not a moral failing, and a phone number underneath of it. Did I see that right or not? And I had to look back and make sure I had seen it right. Alcohol addiction is a disease, not a moral failing. I didn't get the phone number. I toyed with the idea of getting it, but I didn't. But it caused a lot of questions in my mind. What was prompting this message? There was no more to it than that. That's what it said. What does it cost to put a message like that out in front of thousands and thousands of people every day? What would prompt someone to do that? And I can only come up with two conclusions why someone would do that. And number one is either they're making money off of their program from people that call that number, or else they really believe they're doing people a favor. And they really believe they're helping people by putting out a message like that. Now, maybe there might be a third option in where they're kind of in a program because they feel better about it. There could be that option also. But it's thoughts that were going through my mind. So this rolled around in my mind for several weeks, months maybe actually. And I would think about this every now and then. I decided to see if this was part of a bigger program or something. And so I did what we do when we're curious about something. In the 21st century, I went to Google and I typed in alcohol addiction is, and before I got, I don't remember how far I got typed, and this popped up, alcohol addiction is a disease. And there were thousands of sites that came up. I did not read many of them. I didn't feel like I needed to read many of them, but I did bring one along to read a few excerpts of an article to you. I found an overwhelming number of sites. Let me read to you just, and I'm going to just pick and choose here, only for sake of time. Well, some of it may not be. Yeah, I don't want to read anything that is very subversive, okay? But you'll be able to pick out what's happening here. Let me read to you about this man's journey. Addiction, this is his title, Addiction is a Disease, Not a Moral Failure. I am an alcoholic with 4 years sobriety. I was formerly in the running to become the next CEO of a huge bracket money management firm. But alcohol caught up with me in my mid-40s, and I blew up my life in a spectacular fashion. I have no way of going and checking out whether this man is telling the truth or whether he's, but he easily could be, okay? As is the current typical outcome for an untreated and unaware addict, I went to jail, lost my family, my job, and most of my net worth in the process. I faced the cold choice all addicts finally face, quit or die. And thanks to the grace of God, I was able to make the decision finally to live life as a sober being and carry on. Now, I want to just make a comment about this. This was the only mention he made of the grace of God or God's power, that, as I remember. And I wonder why he even mentioned it, because, well, let's go on and read. So I'm going to jump down here a little bit. He talks a little bit about his rehab experience and so on, and how he gained sobriety and how he enjoyed it. Now that I have finally gotten sober, I have had time to reflect upon my entire life experience at some length. I realize now that I was born an alcoholic. My wiring, and he has that in quotation marks, was defective. And I was genetically doomed from birth to suffer from the disease of alcoholism. When I was 14 and just starting out on the long, rotten roads toward a lifetime of struggle with addiction, no one ever told me then or later on in words that I could understand that I may have been different from other kids. No one told me that wonderful feelings I experienced when I used drugs and alcohol may have been different from how the rest of humanity reacted when doing the same things. No one told me that I might have a progressive, probably fatal disease that only 1 in 10 suffer from. No one ever told me that hardship, suffering, and pain were the highest probable outcome for how my life would be lived. No one told me that some people's brain chemistry is twisted from birth, that genetics has a big role in that, and that these are clear signs to watch out for and let me know I could be one of them, in quotation marks. In short, no one adequately prepared me for the agony that was to come in my personal life. And I'm going to jump some more here. There's some more here I would like to read, but I'm just going to leave it for now. We do not talk about it, and I'm just jumping through here. We do not talk about it. We do not study it scientifically, addictions, like other diseases. We have no statistics on what treatments work and don't work. We haven't studied the genetic components like they do with other diseases. The medical community has a problem even calling it a disease. Why? 30 to 45 million people in the U.S. have it and are walking around with it, set to explode right in this moment. What other disease has so many afflicted with so little ongoing research into its nature? Now, I hope that none of you are starting to latch on to this idea. I hope you're picking out all the error in it. But what was said here was absolutely false, that there is no... Well, okay, I say it's absolutely false. The treatments that work and all, the reason that people don't think that there's any research and proof of treatments that work is because they're unwilling to accept the ones that work, okay? You understand that. There's a word called repentance. Okay, let's go down to this last part that I want to read yet. Tackling and correcting society's errant views about addiction and addicts is a massive undertaking which is likely to take at least a full generation or two. Addiction is a disease like diabetes, like Alzheimer's, like cancer, but it's not treated like one. Addicts are reviled as weak individuals with no willpower or social conscience, who care only about themselves and destroy the lives of those around them. And we could go on and read about how he talks about how society pushes these people to the back and doesn't care about them and so on and so forth. And there could be a little grain of truth in what he's saying. But what is the real problem with what I just read? What is at the core of all of this? I'll tell you what it is. It was a glaring, I don't remember where what number it was, but it was on the top 10 of Google when I put in this phrase. This was the boldface title of one article. It said, it put its finger right on the problem. It said, "Put away the guilt. Put away the guilt. Scientific advances offer even more explanation why addiction is a disease of the brain, not a moral failing." You're shaking your heads. I'm glad you are. I'm glad you can pick that up. I expected you to, or I wouldn't have read those things to you. I was surprised. I was amazed when I found how widely this was being promoted. And the question went through my mind. I don't know if I should ask this here or not, but I wonder if I could go just down the road and put up a sign that says exactly the opposite. Would that be okay? Could I put up a billboard that says, "Alcohol addiction is a moral failure, not a disease of the mind"? What would happen if I tried that? What would be the problem? What would be the root? Well, I might make people feel bad. I might provoke some guilt, right? And you see how this is a huge problem at the very core of this type of thinking. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised. And I'm preaching to a number of young people this morning, but you're not going to stay 17, 18, 19, 20 all your lives, thankfully. I mean, enjoy it. I'm not, but you're, that didn't sound right. It didn't come out like I meant it. Okay, I'm sorry. But, so I'm going to plant this seed, but maybe I shouldn't be surprised that this teaching is all over on the internet and now on billboards. Maybe the billboards have been around. Have any of you seen billboards that said similar things? Okay. So there's been a few around. That was the first I encountered it just a little while ago. But maybe I shouldn't be surprised, because at the very root of this, what's happening here has been happening in counseling and quote Christian counseling for years now. It's not your problem. It's the way people have treated you. I'm not talking about, okay, let me make this clear. It does happen in alcohol and addiction cases, but it happens in a far broader sense than that too. And the problem is that it's a lot more subtle to pick out sometimes in a billboard that says, "It's not your fault if you're an alcohol addict. That's a disease you were born with." Sometimes it comes in a whole lot more subtle ways than that. Now, it's easy. It was easy for you to pick out the error in what I read. I believe so. But what if we bring this a little closer home? And let's be really, really, really honest with ourselves. Do I ever believe that I'm wired just a little bit differently? I can find victory over moral temptations, except in these circumstances, it's the way I'm wired. When I'm faced with these things, the way I'm wired, I fail. It's just the way I am. It doesn't have to be something like that. It can come in a lot of ways. And I've heard similar things from this, not from this group. I don't know you this well, but from people you're related to somehow. Okay, we're all sons of Adam, right? We have that nature that I'm not proud of my pickup truck. It's not that. I just like LED lights and puddle lights under the wheel wells and the chrome guard. Just, you know, there's no pride in it. I just like it to be nice and clean, and that's why I put it on my WhatsApp status when it's nice and washed up. And all right, I took that a little bit, but you see where we're getting at? It's not really what it is, it's just the way I am. You will probably largely have to make the application to this. I think I understand this side. I've been there just a few years ago. I know it's different over here. But maybe relationships aren't a problem for you, except when I just can't take it when so-and-so comes around, or when she acts like that, or you fill in the blank, okay? It's the way I'm made. It's the way I'm wired. I'm fine most of the time, except for then. You know what the problem is with that? The exact same problem I read about. There's a wiring problem with me. Okay, there's the way I'm made. I'm pretty much fine except for these situations. Now, it is very built into our human nature, to our Adamic nature, to want to shift responsibility. And that's where we're going with the rest of the sermon. We're not going to talk about addictions and so on so much anymore, but we're going to talk about taking personal responsibility for our actions. Actually, we're going to talk more about not taking personal responsibility for our actions and where we are in life. But it is very, very common to our nature to want to shift blame, and even in things that do not have a moral consequence necessarily, okay? I know the feeling of my phone ringing about 8:30 in the morning, and it's an installer that's going to put up a garage door, and he says, this door is the wrong color, or it doesn't fit the opening that it was ordered for. Can you identify with that, Sonny? And the first thing you do is go to make sure it's the manufacturer's fault or the customer's fault somewhere, right? You don't want to be the one responsible. Okay, so it's built into our nature. Now, that's not necessarily, I mean, if you ordered a door the wrong color or whatever it is in your work, that's not necessarily, that is not a moral failure, okay, if in itself. But I'm just showing you how it's built right into us. I want to excuse myself in this situation. And so much more when it is a moral failing. So when you think that it's just you, I want to remind you of the verse in 1 Corinthians 10:13, there hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. You are not as unique as what you would like to convince yourself you are sometimes. It's just the way it is. So I would like to look at five identifying marks of people who refuse to accept responsibility. Not necessarily claiming that they have a moral failure, a disease is what I meant to say. Not necessarily claiming they have a disease, but shifting the blame, refusing to take responsibility for where I am. Do you know that this problem is almost as old as mankind itself? You do. If you think, just a minute, go to Genesis 3. And the first point I have is blaming others. All right, so you'll find these points that we're about to make in universal in people that do not want to take responsibility themselves. One of the first and one of the most common and the first ever recorded incident when someone was approached with a failure. That's what we're going to look at. People that were approached with a failure. The very most common one is to throw the blame on someone else or to endeavor to do that. And you know this story when God came to Adam and Eve. And in verse 11, we'll just start in there. God said, "Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat?" And the man said, well, he didn't say well, but "the woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat. And the Lord God said unto the woman, what is this that thou hast done? And the woman said, the serpent beguiled me and I did eat. And then the God went to the serpent and started there with judgment. I have this is a if you want to talk about this over lunch, I would enjoy hearing the discussion. We don't have recorded that God never asked the serpent, "What have you done?" He just started there with his curse. Why is that? That's not something we're going to try and sort out this morning. He asked Adam, then he went to Eve, and then he started from the serpent and worked back, however you want to say it. Okay, so blaming others. You know, Adam and Eve here, nobody had to teach them to shift the blame. That was just what happened by nature. In fact, it makes me wonder if they didn't start blaming each other before God came and asked them what they had done. Maybe Adam said, "You should have never given that to me." And Eve said, that serpent made it sound like it was okay. Maybe they had these discussions before God ever came. It's easy for me to believe that they might have. But nonetheless, try to put yourself in Adam's shoes or Eve's shoes here. I know what it's like to feel guilty. And so do you. And it's not a good feeling. But these were adults, and this was the first pang of guilt they had ever faced. You don't remember the first time you felt guilty. You might remember sometimes that you felt guilty when you were pretty young, but I don't. Just to realize, I'm sure they didn't comprehend completely what all was lost here, but to realize, feel this guilt, and here comes God in on top of it and says, "Hey, what's going on?" And it came without even trying, without any mental trying to decide what to do. Well, Eve gave it to me, and Eve said, "Well, the serpent beguiled me. He tricked me into it." Now, this point is a little bit tricky on blaming others because there is a grain of truth. Let's try and sort this out. It is true that people do hurt us and make it really, really hard to respond in a Christ-like way. Not impossible, but really hard. It is true that people take advantage of us. Brother Steve talked about that this morning. It is true that because of other people, we are put into temptations. Maybe someone of the opposite gender, but maybe just someone telling dirty jokes, or I say just, or introducing pornography into the group, or take it where you want to. It is true, and it is true that if that person were in your life, those temptations may be a little bit different. It's true. I remember some people introducing me to temptations that I probably would not have faced those specific temptations. You get what I'm saying? Those specific temptations, if it hadn't been for that individual. But where we go wrong is when we believe that they are the problem and not me for my failure. That is where we go wrong. To you young people especially, I know, I understand that it is extremely hard to choose right when it seems like everyone else is making the wrong decisions, foolish choices. I know that. It is extremely hard to forgive people and just release them from their obligation to pay you back somehow to make it right when they've hurt you. I know that. Or when they tread on your feelings, or when they told something that wasn't true about you, or on and on, they hurt you. Listen, it might be your brother or your sister. It might even be your parents that unknowingly, or maybe even knowingly, did that at times. Embrace the fact right now, today, that these things do not excuse you in any way, shape, or form, but rather, they are an opportunity to actually put Christ's teachings into practice. You see, if you were never hurt, if you were never tread upon, if you were never faced temptations, severe temptations, you couldn't put Jesus' example into practice. How would you forgive if no one ever really hurt you? If no one ever told lies about you? Or shunned you or excluded you? Or whatever temptation we could talk about this morning. You can't blame it on others. Did Adam tell the truth? Did Eve tell the truth? Absolutely they told the truth. Did it make any difference in their accountability to God? None whatsoever. What they said was true. But what they implied was false. Okay, number two. We don't have to go far at all. One more chapter in the Bible and we have someone else that was confronted. And this one I have written this way, a mark of people that are unwilling to accept personal responsibility, and that is asking subversive questions. Subversive here is, and that's what I mean by that is meant to distract, questions that will deflect what's going on here. And this is Cain 4, 9 and 10. And the Lord said unto Cain, where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, what hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. There are meant these questions that you can retort to, to an accusation are meant to distract. And maybe sometimes they're pretty obvious. They are in our children sometimes. You ask them, and I'm here to tell you that, well, we get better about hiding what we're really doing, but we don't do much different. When I ask my children, you can usually find out if they're not guilty, if they're innocent, and there's a straightforward answer. But if there's guilt, there's a different way they answer, okay? And we adults tend to be that same way, although we try to be more subtle with it. We can. I shouldn't say we're. That's our tendency, is to do that. They come out in questions like this. When someone is approached by their attitude, it might be what they're wearing, what they're approaching, you will often hear a question similar to this. Well, how is that different then? You know what? Over there let's pick on Leola this morning. At Leola, they do that. And worse. So what? What does that have to do with the issue? They don't even need to be logical questions. What was the answer to Cain's question? Are you your brother's keeper? Yes. To a certain extent. Maybe not exactly the way he asked it, perhaps. He wasn't his babysitter. Maybe that's the way Cain was asking it. I don't know. Did Cain find release from his responsibility by trying to throw people off track with questions? Absolutely not. He was dealing with God himself. There's sometimes we can throw people off for a time, but not. No, it made no difference. Thirdly, and this is the response. This is more something that you don't do with your mouth so much, or blaming others and asking subversive questions, but smoothing over sin. Smoothing it over to avoid the shame that goes with it. And we're going to talk, if the Lord continues to lead Sunday evening, a little bit more about the shame that comes with sin. So I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that. And I don't think we're going to go to this example and read it. But in 1 Samuel 15, maybe we should go there. But I trust you know the story. Samuel came to Saul, and there was this was in the context of the battle of the Amalekites. Okay, he had gone ahead and done the sacrifice, which he shouldn't have done, and then he went on and he saved some of the animals alive and tried to throw blame on that. He also tried to throw blame on others, on the people had done it. And finally his response was, let me get the words, 1 Samuel 15, let me get his words, because he said it so clearly. He said it twice, but I'm going to read his second response. Then Saul said, I have sinned, yet honor me now, I pray thee, before the elders of my people and before Israel, and turn again with me, that I may worship the Lord thy God. You know what was underneath of this? You know why Saul responded this way? If we deal with this sin, nobody's going to respect me anymore. Let's smooth it over and things will be a lot better, a lot easier for me, right? We don't need to make a big deal about it. What are people going to think about me? This is a weak example, but I hope that you can take it and apply it. This is just an example that I thinking of. If the cooks, we trust they're preparing a lunch. If something very nasty, abominable fell into something that they were making, into the cake mix, if you were baking a cake, and let's say a dead mouse, because that's something really disgusting, got into it, would you have the idea that it's okay, we can smooth it over with icing and it'll look good anyway? Would you be okay with the cooks doing that for lunch? Absolutely not. And sin is just as disgusting and abominable to God. And yet, somehow from our perspective, you can smooth it over and make it look right. And I want to be careful how I say this, because I don't want to leave the wrong impression. But I want you young people to understand something, and older people, I need to understand this. That sin is sin. No matter whether it's covered with a plain suit, cape, dress, and covering or not. And if I just devalued being separate from the world in our dress and in your minds, you misunderstood what I said. But there's not a difference between someone that goes to church and professes something and dresses conservatively and looks holy but is practicing sin and someone that just throws it out and practices sin. We are not perfect. I understand that. And there will be temptations, and there will be times you need to ask forgiveness. Your thoughts stray, or whatever it is. But to practice sin and to welcome the temptation and know that this is an ongoing practice, you cannot make up for it in other areas. Lord willing, we're going to talk about that just a little bit more, about trying to make up in other areas. Okay, not in this sermon, in another one. It simply will not produce good results. Did it work for Saul? Think just a minute about Saul and David. David sinned too. He sinned very greatly. You know what he said when he was approached? I have sinned. He didn't go on to say, but now let's be careful and honor me before the people. He just said, I have sinned. There's a shadow over David's life because of the sin he committed. There is. You can't get away from that. But his end was not like Saul's. And it comes down in part to this, trying to smooth it over and not really dealing with it at its core. Fourthly, the way people act is making up in other areas. I got confused just a minute ago. I'm sorry. I was thinking we weren't going here. Yes, making up in other areas, closely related to what we just talked about. Matthew 23, Jesus was condemning the Pharisees, and we could go a lot of different places in the New Testament, but these verses are clear. Probably the most clearly that it says the point we're making here, they were not necessarily, well, they were. Jesus was confronting them with their lifestyle. And in Matthew 23, 14 and 15, he says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore ye shall receive the greater damnation. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for ye compass land and sea and land, to make one proselyte. And when he is made, ye make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves." Imagine how hard this was for the Pharisees to take. Imagine how hard. Because it's easy for me to put the Pharisees in a box and say, well, they were a bunch of big hypocrites and they should have known better. But you know who they were? They were the religious elite. They were the elite. They were the religious leaders, the people that looked up to as being religious. They had things right. They had a form that was stringent. And along comes this man, well, God's son, but along comes this man in their mind and turns this whole thing upside down. And imagine the choices that they were forced into making. Were they going to accept this man as the son of God, or were they going to just get rid of him? And we know that they eventually had him crucified. Now, surely the Pharisees were gaining some favor with God by their stringent lifestyle. No. Doesn't mean that everything they were doing was wrong in itself. No, it doesn't mean that at all. Again, I want to be careful how we express this point. But sin is sin, but sin is sin, like we said before, whether it's covered in plain clothes or not. But on this point, I want us to understand too, you can't make up for things you're unwilling to give up by being a great personal evangelist or by teaching Sunday school or by leading a really thought-provoking devotions. You can do that. People are good enough to be two-faced and they can do it, but you can't make up for it. There's just no way of making up. If there's sin in your life, it's sin. The Pharisees had a stringent lifestyle. Did it excuse them from the filth on the inside? No, absolutely not. Jesus was plain about that. And last point I have, and this is, comparing oneself with others. And that goes right hand in hand with blaming others and asking subversive questions, but comparing oneself with others. And I don't have a Bible example here that we can go to and turn and say, see, right here was someone that was confronted with a fault in their life, and they just compared themselves with someone else. But it does tell us in 2 Corinthians that there was a group of people that was comparing themselves among themselves. For we dare not make ourselves of the number, or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves. They think well of themselves, but they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise. It is not wise to compare yourself with other people. And one of the reasons it's not wise is because when you do that, you automatically pick out your strongest points and compare it to the person on the bench beside you, their weakest points. That's what you automatically do. I don't know of any of you that's tempted to take your failures and weaknesses and compare them to the other person's strong points. Sometimes we feel inferior and we do something similar to that, but we don't do that. We don't say, well, I need to grow up and mature because all the other students were more mature than me in this way. No, that's not the way we do it. We say, well, yeah, I did do this, but and most of the group did that, and so on. And so it wasn't actually that bad. This is the way people are. It's kind of the way that we just are. I don't know if any of you here have taught school or are teaching school, but you'll see that as you raise a family. But if you teach school, you also see this. Well, yesterday, so-and-so did that. You compare yourself. Again, it's just... Yeah, we're repeating somewhat what we said. It is somewhat unfortunate that it has to be this way, but it is this way. Just embrace this fact now. If you follow your natural inclination to justify yourself by others, you will always be able to do it. Just settle that in your mind. It is that way. If I want to be able to justify something in my mind, I can find something in any one of these brothers' lives here that I can... Real or supposed, I can justify myself if that's what I'm looking for. Now, to be humble, you can certainly justify yourself by my life also. And that is no license to be inconsistent. It's no license to be careless. Let's be careful. But it is that way. Does it work? Did it work for the Corinthians? Will it work? No, it won't work. So, in conclusion, let me give you four very quickly. And these points I want to talk about later on, hopefully Sunday night, if the Spirit continues to lead that way. But so I'm not going to expound on them. But let me give you four points to remember in thinking about our personal accountability and taking responsibility for our lives. Number one, I will give account of myself to God. Romans 14:12. Who are you that judges another person's subject? Another servant. Every one of us will give account of himself to God. And I wish that somehow the reality of that could be even more real in my life. As I go through life and you deal with struggles and problems and other people and just realizing, you know what? But for me, I'm going to give account of myself to God. I want to help others along to glory, but I'm going to give account of myself. Number two, God is not mocked. Galatians 6:7. That's the law of sowing and reaping. You won't take advantage of God. You reap what you sow. Third principle, some men's sins are open beforehand, some follow after. 1 Timothy 5:24. And lastly, fourth principle that I just want us to remember is that Christ is the only safe measuring stick. And that comes from Ephesians 4:13. He's talking to the church here, but the church is made up of individuals. It's made up of Bible school students and Bible school teachers and Bible school evangelist and so on. And he's talking about the church, and we studied this last Sunday. I believe it was. Last Sunday or the Sunday before. Till we all come in the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. That's how you measure how tall you are, by Jesus Christ. I don't believe that I'm going to give an invitation this morning. We're going to pause for a word of prayer, and then I'm going to open it up. I'm going to give you an invitation. But it's going to be an invitation of, if you have anything to share, any clearing, anything that you simply want to drive a stake in the ground and say, I haven't been. I have been deflecting the blame my life. I have had a diseased attitude, and it's just me and the way I am. I want to give you that opportunity this morning to just rise and make that public if you want to, or any other word of testimony if you have one. Let's bow our heads for a word of prayer. Dear righteous Father in heaven, we thank you for the privilege again of being here this morning. We thank you for your Spirit's faithfulness in speaking to my needs, our needs, as we look into taking responsibility for where we are in life. Help us to be real with it. Help us to be honest with ourselves. Help us to measure our lives by you and not by any of these other things that would distract us. Pray that you would grant us courage and strength to be victorious. Give us wisdom for the days ahead. Help us to know how Jesus would live if he were here as a human today, and help and then give us grace to put that into everyday life. Bless us, we pray again. We ask according to your will in Jesus' name. Amen.